Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning, everyone. And before we get to Mayor de Blasio, who's going to be our first guest today, just to follow up on what many of you were just hearing on the BBC, for those of you who don't keep daily track of the bestseller lists, guess what shot up to number one on Amazon, thanks to the president who tried to shoot it down? Yes, it is that Michael Wolff book about the Trump administration called Fire and Fury, which is revealing the degree of dysfunction in the West Wing and possibly in the president's mental state. As you might have heard, Trump sent a cease and desist letter to the publisher demanding a retraction of things in the book and that it not be published on its scheduled release date next week. The BBC was just talking about how it looks like they're going to attack the book politically rather than legally now. But what happened in response to the cease and desist? Well, they moved up the publication date from next week to today and immediately released the book. And guess what? It's instantly number one on Amazon. And Michael Wolff, the author, went on the Today Show this morning in response to that and said this.
Where do I send the box of chocolates?
You think he's helping you sell books?
Absolutely. I mean, and not only is he helping me sell books, but he's helping me prove the point of the book.
And that was Mike Wolff with Savannah Guthrie on the Today Show. We'll play more of that interview coming up. And later this morning, we'll speak with Tom Steyer, the Democratic activist who's running those TV commercials you may have seen calling for Trump's impeachment, even though Nancy Pelosi says that's not what the Democrats should be focusing on right now, and that would be getting ahead of the law and the facts and the Russia investigation. That's coming up in our second hour, Tom Steyer, including whether these questions that Michael Wolff is raising that are very serious, if true, about the president's mental state will affect Tom Steyer's impeachment campaign. Also today, we'll take a closer look at Jeff Sessions and the legal marijuana industry. How much does his new pronouncement yesterday mean he's actually going to use federal power to reverse the voters' will in California, Oregon, Washington State, Colorado, and Massachusetts? Am I leaving any out? Where referenda have legalized recreational marijuana. That's at 10:30. And we'll have Andrea Stewart-Cousins today, the Democratic leader in the New York State Senate, reacting to Governor Cuomo's State of the State address, including his proposals to use state power to fight sexual misconduct. All that is coming up, but we begin, as we usually do on Fridays, with Mayor Bill de Blasio and our Ask the Mayor segment. Mr. Mayor, thanks as always, and welcome back to WNYC.
Good morning, Brian.
And this has become such a popular thing that for the first time, I'm looking at my caller board, and without me even giving out the phone number, all our lines are full. I don't know if that's good or bad. But
it's a good thing, Brian. Democracy in action, brother.
It might mean that the 10 most activist New Yorkers have put us on their speed dials and are calling you every Friday. But nonetheless, as some of those folks finish up, it's 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692 for the mayor. Or you can tweet a question, because there the lines never get full. Just use the hashtag AskTheMayor. Let's begin on the cold weather. We're at a point now where people can get frostbite on exposed skin in about a half hour. How's the Code Blue process going with people living on the street?
It's going very well. NYPD and social services are working very closely together. We had about 20 people we brought in last night, primarily voluntarily. I think at least one was involuntary. And, you know, there's a great focused outreach effort to make sure people are safe. But I want to remind all New Yorkers, if you see someone homeless who's out there in the elements, call 311. We'll get help to them right away. If it appears to be an immediate urgent situation, call 911. But we're very adamant about getting people in and making sure they're safe.
I read that 6 NYCHA public housing complexes were without heat or hot water at times yesterday. Can you confirm that and tell us if it's all been restored?
The update I can give you Brian, is that as the problems have been occurring, we've been getting the heat back on in each development. There are still a few for sure that we have more work to do. Here's the bottom line. I went out to Woodside Houses in Queens yesterday and actually met with the general manager for all of NYCHA, Michael Kelly, and the guy who's in charge of all heating for NYCHA. It was fascinating to see the challenges they face every day. They've got a boiler in one NYCHA development goes back to 1954, many others that are 30, 40 years or more older. Look, the blunt truth is, because for decades NYCHA did not get the investment it needed, a lot of these boilers are in really tough shape, but the folks who work at NYCHA do a great job every day figuring out how to keep them going. So we definitely have some developments right now that need heat restored that in many cases can take only hours. That was the case in Woodside yesterday. I went out there because we got the report that it was down within hours. They got it back. Some are more persistent problems, but bluntly, we're going to deal with them every single day, and in most cases, we can get them back online quickly.
Last week, we mentioned the complaints about inadequate heat at Rikers Island, and you said you were going to look into it. Have you?
Yes, I have. I spoke to Commissioner Cynthia Brand, and here's the overall situation on Rikers Island. There are 10 buildings that house inmates. Two of them have had sporadic heat problems. One of those is the one we just announced we're going to shut down for good in the next few months by the summer. So there's two buildings that have problems. The other eight generally do not. On those two, typically when there is a problem like NYCHA, it's a matter of a few hours. Again, older boilers that have problems sometimes, but usually can be fixed quickly. I think there's one instance where it took longer and they had to move inmates to another building temporarily. So the overall situation is stable. Generally, when we have a problem, it's brief. But the good news is, of the two buildings that have had more consistent problems, one of them will be shut down entirely. No inmates will be in them within a few months.
And anything on plowing? There were 8 inches in Manhattan, but more in Queens. I guess every mayor knows the legend of Mayor John Lindsay's popularity going way downhill after Queens wasn't effectively plowed following a big snowfall in 1969.
Oh, yes. And unfortunately, you know, for John Lindsay, people had every right to hold him accountable. This is one of the most important things we do after public safety. You know, one of the most important things we do is make sure that the streets are passable. And here's what I found. You need to lead from the front. I was out and around the city yesterday. I visited with sanitation workers, went to see one of the garages where work was being done to repair the vehicles to get them back out immediately, talked to elected officials. And what I think is important is to lead from the front in these situations. But the other thing is we needed better equipment. This is what we learned when I came into office, that actually sanitation did not have the right equipment for a lot of outer borough areas that have smaller streets. We now have over, I think it's 160 of the smaller snow plows and the kind of vehicles that can get down any size street and clear them and salt them. Now that we've pumped up those numbers, we see the coverage much better, much stronger. But overall, especially with the blizzard we had, you know, we had the biggest blizzard in New York City history on my watch, and sanitation did an amazing job of clearing the streets after that, you know, basically in a day and change. So I think New Yorkers should hold us to a high standard, but I feel very good about how sanitation handled this last storm.
Just be glad you're not going hiking on Mount Washington in New Hampshire today. I read the wind chill is supposed to be close to minus 100.
That's crazy. But hey, but you say that, Brian, I want to warn all the New Yorkers, remind you, tonight and Saturday night, we're talking with wind chill, negative 10, negative 20 kind of range. So I really want to remind people, you know, stay in if you can. If you go out, be careful.
The Mount Washington story did make me look up today what New York's highest peak is in the city, the highest point in New York City, and it's Tote Hill on Staten Island at 401 feet, not quite Mount Washington.
Not quite.
And the highest point in Manhattan, I looked it up, I figured it would be the Cloisters, which it's not, but it's nearby there in Bennett Park, which is very near there in Hudson Heights at 265 feet above sea level. So a little New York trivia for you.
Very good, Brian. You've educated the people.
Andrew in Harlem. You're on WNYC. Hi, Andrew.
Hi, thank you. Mayor de Blasio, I think it's incredibly telling that when you spoke with former DNA Info and Gothamist reporters, you had no idea what percentage of New Yorkers are car owners, and you had no idea what the median income of a car owner is. It's a dead giveaway that you're uninformed about transportation policy in your own city and that you haven't immersed yourself and deeply studied what congestion pricing is and what it would do. Rather, you dismiss it reflexively, either because you think it's regressive or because you're afraid of the political risk. Here are the answers to those two questions that you couldn't answer. 45% of New York City households have a car, and the median income of those households is double that of car-free households.
The example, well, I appreciate your script you're reading, but what the point is, I don't think it changes the core reality. I have proposed a millionaire's tax as the way to address the MTA issue. I think it is the best and most sustainable tool to fund the long-term repairs we need in the MTA. And given that the Trump tax plan was a giveaway to the wealthy and corporations, I think it makes even more sense to have a millionaire's tax. I think there are problems with every congestion pricing plan I've seen, and we still haven't seen a new plan in Albany. So my basic views are not changed by those specific points you make. It doesn't change the fundamental problem that there has not been a plan that has addressed the regressive nature of congestion pricing.
Regressive nature in what way? He talks about the sort of regressive nature of who can own a car. Well, let me ask you it this way. The governor floated this idea in general of congestion pricing. No, he didn't reveal in a State of the State address this week what the details would be. And I think you've said recently that you're open-minded, though skeptical, on this at this point. When he does reveal it, what would be deal breakers for you in a congestion pricing plan?
I appreciate the question, so I'll answer it in this order. First, the first concern I have is that I don't think it is the best way to address the MTA crisis. I think a millionaire's tax is a better way, and it's a live, actual proposal. You can see it. You can touch it.
You could do both, couldn't you?
You could, in theory. This is true, but I would say here's the point. I would urge everyone who's interested in this topic to actually pay attention to the plan that's on the table now and decide how you feel about that. And if you agree with it, help us get that done. On the question of congestion pricing, what the governor put out was very, very broad. The things I've said consistently I'd like to see addressed. First of all, disproportionate impact on Brooklyn and Queens. How is that going to be addressed? What is going to, if there were such a plan, what would be done for Brooklyn and Queens to make up for the disproportionate impact on people from Brooklyn and Queens who would be affected? Second, regressive tax. Despite the specific points that Andrew made, there are a huge number. So 45% of the city is car owners. That's almost 4 million people. A huge percentage, doesn't matter what the median is, a huge percentage of those people are working class and middle class people for whom a congestion pricing style toll would have a real impact. A lot of people in public housing own a car. A lot of working class people own a car and use it for work or use it because they have to get to a hospital or whatever it may be. What is going to be done to address their needs? What's going to be done to address hardship cases, particularly around medical care, which is, you know, as everyone knows, overwhelmingly centered in Manhattan? So those are issues that could theoretically be addressed, but I've never seen that addressed in a congestion pricing plan.
Fanny in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC with the mayor. Hi, Fanny.
Hi, how are you?
Okay.
So I just called to say I love you to both of you because I called last week and we didn't have heat. Mayor de Blasio, if you remember, and the city got on it right away. I got a call from one of your commissioners a couple hours later, and they sent HPD and DOB and everybody, like, started doing the work for the irresponsible landlord, who, by the way, still hasn't even, like, wiped the snow up in front of the house, and we haven't heard from him nonetheless. But HPD and everybody who was sent to do the work was really great, so I truly appreciate both of your help. It's quite amazing. We have heat and hot water, so it's
all right.
Good.
Fanny, thank you for saying that, and the folks at HPD and buildings, it was really something they wanted to fix, and they did it with tremendous energy. I want to make sure that you and all New Yorkers don't have to go through something like that in the future. I want to urge everyone, please, you know, we have more work to do to make things better, but please always call 311 when heat or hot water is out. And I really am glad you called in, Fanny, because you do have a bad landlord, and we're going to go after him and make sure there's some consequences.
Jeff in Washington Heights, you're on WNYC. Hi, Jeff.
Good morning, Brian. Good morning, Mr. Mayor. I'd like to speak to you as well about the cold weather and how it's impacting many New Yorkers, including myself. If you'll give me 30 seconds, I'll paint you a word picture. I am a senior DREE tenant living in Washington Heights. I'm looking outside my bedroom window, and I see the Hudson River and the George Washington Bridge. I mention that because in the wintertime, when the winds come off the river, my building and many along this avenue feel it with greater impact than perhaps east of here. I'm sitting here talking to you. I'm under the covers. I'm wearing gloves and a football hoodie over my head because my digital thermometer tells me it's 62 degrees in this apartment in my bedroom. This despite the fact that I had a senior organization come in earlier before the winter and winterize my windows. I think my problem is a combination of not enough heat. There is heat coming up, but not enough heat, and also possibly faulty windows that just cannot keep out the cold. That's my micro complaint.
And what are you asking for from the city?
Well, you might ask, Brian, why would you call the mayor when you could just call 311? And my life experience teaches me that when you call 311 in these situations, you'll get an inspector come out maybe in a week, 3 weeks, a month. I heard Chris Cimino on the news tell me next week is going to be a good 20, 30 degrees warmer than today. That won't help me
if an inspector comes out when it's
thawed.
Jeff, and certainly when you have access here to ask the mayor, why would you call 311?
No, and 311, look, I want to say to everyone, if 311 is not responding more quickly in these kind of weather conditions, then that's on us to fix. What I keep reporting to New Yorkers during any cold emergency is our expectation for our own team is to get out quickly, either make the building management fix the problem themselves or the city does it for them. Now, if the city has to do it, we have to mobilize resources. That can take a few days, unfortunately. The best option is always to get the building management to fix the problem immediately. But the response to find out what's going on should be very, very quick. And if it's not happening, I need to fix that. In this case, Jeff, this is a private building, I take it?
Jeff's
okay,
still
we'll
there?
Follow up.
Yes, I am.
Let's make sure Jeff gives his information, Brian,
right,
to
we'll
your folks.
That.
I'll have HPD follow up with him directly today.
Privately owned building, Jeff?
It is indeed, Brian.
Thank you very much. HPD will follow up today.
He said 62 degrees in his apartment. What's the legal minimum? Is it 62 degrees at night and higher in the day?
I want to check my facts. I believe it's 68 during the day, but I want to check that, and I do not know the nighttime. But when we come back next week, I'll have that for you.
Okay. In the governor's state of the state, because of the new Trump tax law, the governor floated this idea of a payroll tax, which might still be federally tax deductible to replace the state income tax, which would be subject to the new cap. Could you do anything like that with a city income tax?
Look, Brian, we're going to look at all those solutions. As I said after the governor's speech, I think it's a creative idea and certainly a timely idea, and I'm glad he's focused on the concept of anything that will provide relief to folks who are now going to go through double taxation because of the Republican tax bill in Washington. You're talking about 600,000 New York City residents who will be hit real hard. The average is about $5,000 more in taxes per person because of what is a wildly unfair piece of legislation that obviously was meant to benefit the wealthy and corporations. And anything that can blunt the impact is worthy. So we're going to work with the governor to see if something can be done on the state level. We're also looking for anything that could be done on the city level.
But he's got that specific proposal, and I realize it has to be vetted, and there might be complications with his payroll tax idea. But he's got one there for the state level. You don't have one yet for the city level.
No, the notion of trying to figure out something that would change our whole approach. I mean, remember, this legislation, for quite a while, we were hoping we could defeat or fundamentally modify. The president only signed it right before Christmas. Our first concern was to make sure that people had an opportunity to do early payments on their property taxes, which a number of New Yorkers took advantage of. But the issue now is looking for anything that would pass legal muster that would allow us to provide additional relief. That's something we're still working on.
And the governor had some anti-sexual harassment proposals in the state of the state, including that any companies doing business with the state would be required to disclose the number of sexual harassment adjudications and non-disclosure agreements that they've executed. Will you do something like that with city contractors?
Yeah, I think that's a great idea, and I give the governor credit for that. I think that makes a lot of sense, and we're going to look to do something similar at the city level. I mean, this is a powerful moment in American history, and a lot of truth is finally coming out, and there needs to be an atmosphere of consequence. So I think holding private companies responsible makes a lot of sense.
And we have a question via Twitter that asks, what does the mayor and the new New York City Council Speaker, Cord Johnson, plan to do in response to the second allegations of sexual harassment against council member Andy King? Now, this is the first I've seen of a second allegation. There's been one allegation of improper conduct having to do with, I'm looking it up here. I'll get that in a second, but can you confirm a second allegation, and what do you think they should do about even one?
The city council has responsibility to address its own ethics concerns. My understanding, the allegation was made formal recently and has been looked at by the city council ethics committee. I have not heard back what they're going to do. That's the first step for the city council ethics committee to investigate. Historically, I think that's happened pretty quickly, so I think everyone would like to hear an answer on that as soon as possible, and then that will tell us how to respond.
The Times on December 14th, just to clarify, said a New York City councilman from the Bronx is facing an ethics inquiry over inappropriate comments made to a staffer. When asked whether he denied making sexually appropriate inappropriate comments, Mr. King did not respond, walking farther back into his office beyond staffers to a group of waiting children. That was back in mid-December, but that's the reporting that I have on it. Peter in Astoria, you're on WNYC with the mayor. Hello.
Thank you, Brian. I'm calling property tax and your initiative to, reformat property taxes throughout New York City. I know that you own two-family buildings in Park Slope. Your combined property taxes, Mr. Mayor, equate my one-family, much, much less bougie area, way down in Flatlands, Brooklyn, far from a subway. So what are you going to do? Are we actually going to see some tax reform for property?
Yeah, I mean, many people have asked me this question on the air and at my 50 town hall meetings, and I've answered the same way over and over again. We have to have an overall property tax reform for New York City. I'm going to initiate a process shortly to do that. It's going to have to take both city legislation and state legislation. It's going to be a very complex process. Here's the ground rules. In the end, we need a more transparent, more consistent property tax system. The thing that you're talking about is not fair. It doesn't make sense that people in neighborhoods where values have moved in different ways end up having to pay in different manners. That's what it's about. It's not that someone sat around in the beginning and said, oh, this neighborhood will pay this much, and another neighborhood pays a different amount. It's all about the speed with which the values of the homes are increasing and what that does to the assessment. There has not, I emphasize, has not been a property tax rate increase in the 4 years that I have been mayor. There will not be one in the budget that we're going to put forward coming up. I don't believe in that approach. The assessments are the issue, but the assessments currently are based on a structure that I think is unfair and inconsistent. So we're going to create a new system. It'll take a lot of work. Here's the kicker, though. It cannot lead us to less overall revenue in any appreciable way, because if we get less revenue, that means fewer police officers, fewer teachers, et cetera. We need to keep the level of city services high. It's working for New York City. We're at a very strong point right now. We have to sustain that. But we can have a more consistent and transparent tax system, especially across neighborhoods and boroughs.
By the way, to update the answer on the required indoor temperature during the winter for providing heat to residents. We looked up the official city website page, and it says between the hours of 6 a.m. and 10 p.m., if the outside temperature falls below 55 degrees, the inside temperature is required to be at least 68 degrees Fahrenheit. So you got that right, Mr. Mayor. And between the hours of 10 p.m. and 6 a.m., the inside temperature is required to be at least 62. So if...
Well, you got that one right. Okay, so one for one each.
If the caller... from Washington Heights is seeing his temperature accurately 62, then that landlord is in violation. Last week, we talked about the record low crime rate, or at least murder rate, that the city seemed to be on track for as the year was ending, including under 300 murders for the first time since the 1950s, I think. And you did make that, we did make that goal, right?
Absolutely, Brian. We're lowest overall crime since the 1950s, and specifically the last time we had under 300 homicides was 1951. And this is just unbelievable what has been achieved by the NYPD, and the fact that they're achieving it more and more working with community partners, working with, you know, neighborhood residents and tenant patrols and the Cure Violence movement. I mean, this is very much about neighborhood policing. I had a great experience out in the 7-5 precinct in Brooklyn a few days ago. I talked to our neighborhood coordination officers, who are, you know, the core of our neighborhood policing strategy. This is a precinct that 20 years ago would average well over 100 murders in a year. I think they had 11 murders last year. We want to keep driving that number down, but the contrast is stunning. I asked these officers, what's different now in the neighborhood policing approach? And they literally, one by one, told me instances where residents who had gotten to know them, who had their cell number, who had their email, alerted them to someone who had an illegal firearm, someone who was selling drugs, someone who had been part of a robbery pattern. They literally said there was a robbery pattern. They were trying to figure out who was behind it. And one of the residents they had befriended pointed out the person to them, and it proved to be the person who was behind the robbery pattern. I mean, this is stopping crime in a whole new way. But the amazing achievement here, it's across the board in the vast majority of the major crime categories, but particularly on homicide. I think a lot of people thought we'd never get below 300 homicides in a city of 8.5 million people. This is the first time it's been achieved since 1951, and everyone should be very proud of that.
There is an article about you in the L.A. Times today comparing you to Mayor Eric Garcetti out there. Spoiler alert, they prefer Garcetti.
Hello.
And one
hello,
hello. Did we lose the mayor's ability to hear me just now? Did something happen to that line? It sounds like the mayor thinks he's been disconnected. Mr. Mayor, are you there? Can you hear me? Can the mayor hear me? Oh, we lost the mayor. Well, we're going to try to get the mayor back in just a second and finish up. We've only got about 5 minutes left in this segment anyway. So I'll tell you that coming up after that, assuming we can reconnect that line, is a closer look at Jeff Sessions and the legal marijuana industry. How much does his new pronouncement yesterday mean that the U.S. Attorney General is actually going to use federal power to reverse the voters' will in California, Oregon, and Washington, and Colorado, and Massachusetts, and am I leaving any out, where referenda have legalized recreational marijuana? That'll be coming up next as soon as we finish up with the mayor. And next hour, have you seen those commercials by Tom Steyer, who's a hedge fund billionaire? That's why he's got a lot of money he can blow on commercials. But he's also a progressive activist the last 5 years after he got out of the hedge fund business. And he's running these TV commercials calling for Trump to be impeached. Tom Steyer, have you seen those on television? If you watch cable news, you've definitely seen them. And Tom Steyer is going to come on for an interview next hour. Nancy Pelosi is not a big fan of this approach. And they may be button heads a little more closely this year, because Steyer's expected to make some kind of big announcement about his future on Monday. We'll ask him about that. He may be about to primary Dianne Feinstein, who some progressives in California have decided has become too centrist, Senator Feinstein, or he might be about to run for governor of California. So Tom Steyer coming up next hour. I think we have the mayor's line reconnected.
Yes.
Okay.
Hey, Brian.
Sorry about that. No problem. So I was just asking about this LA Times article that compares you to Mayor Eric Garcetti out there. Spoiler alert, they prefer him. And one line about you says, he, de Blasio, has been dismayingly tentative in challenging the powerful and pugnacious police unions. More than 3 years after the killing of Eric Garner, an African-American resident of Staten Island, not a single police officer in New York has received implicit bias training. Do you dispute that as a true fact?
Oh, I don't dispute the fact that implicit bias training has taken too long, and I'm unhappy about that. And I've made very clear to the commissioner and his whole team that that has to be up and running immediately. But I want to be clear. I've not seen the article. I think people should be very clear about how much reform has taken place in the NYPD. The entire police force has been retrained on de-escalation techniques. 5,000-plus officers retrained in how to handle emotionally disturbed people. The Neighborhood Policing Initiative has changed the entire culture of policing. And the fact that crime is down to these levels, while we're creating a closer bond between police and community, that's profound reform. I haven't seen the article, but the things that have been moving have been aggressive and consistent. We have never let the union leadership stand in our way on any of these things. We're going to have body cameras on all of our patrol officers by the end of next year, by the end of 2019. This is exactly the blueprint for reform that this city hoped to achieve, and I think we're now becoming a model for the country of both crime reduction and improving police-community relations.
We have time for one more call, and it's going to be Leslie on the Upper West Side. Leslie, you're on WNYC with the mayor. Hi.
Good morning, Mayor. I am a fan of yours, but I have a serious problem on West 100th Street between Amsterdam and Columbus, and then between Columbus and Manhattan Avenue. It is a self-enforcement area because the 24th Police Precinct, Fire Company 76, Ladder 22, Riverside Health Center building, and Frederick Douglass houses all are on that block. It is impossible for sanitation to do routine street sweeping because the cars are not only illegally parked, but they're illegally double parked. It is impossible to get that street cleaned on a routine, regular basis. The area in front of the 24th Police Precinct, as well as around the fire building, are never cleaned. Anybody else would get a ticket for having such filth on in their alleys. And we need some coordination of sanitation, police, fire, so that street can be cleaned on a regular basis.
And I have heard this about other, and I'd like you to address that particular block if you're familiar with it, but I've also heard this about other police precinct blocks where the police officers park their own cars willy-nilly and just consider themselves exempt from the laws that apply to other people. But go ahead.
Yeah, Leslie, thank you very much for raising this, and please leave your contact information with WNYC so we can follow up with you directly. I think it's a really good point Leslie's making. I think we have to do better. Brian, I think this is kind of in the vein of it's not just about police. I think in many ways we've had situations like this around the city that were just tolerated for a lot of years that obviously there's solutions for, and we have to shake things up and figure out a better way. So I want to get that done. I will have our team follow up on what can be done specifically on West 100th Street. But I think, bluntly, we need to come up with and we need to publicize a broader strategy because this is a fixable problem. If it means that we want people to not park, you know, for a certain hour so things can be cleaned or move their cars temporarily, there are ways to achieve this. We cannot leave neighborhood residents feeling their areas too dirty. So I'm going to work on this and get my team on it, and we'll follow up with Leslie.
Is there an explicit policy pertaining to police officers' private vehicles around precincts?
You know, there's clearly an understanding that our officers, that's a very sensitive reality. They have to be there, and a lot of times they're going to be there long hours, and we have the need sometimes to keep them on for an additional shift, et cetera. And they may be called in at any time. So the notion that there is defined parking for them right near their precinct makes lots of sense. That being said, we can work with our officers and work with precincts to figure out how to also accommodate the need to keep the community clean. I think it's a fixable problem.
Mr. Mayor, as always, thank you very much. Talk to you next week.
Thanks, Brian.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Coming up next, what Attorney General Jeff Sessions' announcement of new federal powers or a return to more federal powers over state marijuana laws, what it means coming up next.